Good afternoon. I call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order at 1:33 p.m. Tuesday, April 27th. We're meeting today in room 205 in the Capitol Building. Please remember to silence your cell phones as a courtesy. And those members that are attending by Teams, remember to mute yourself when you're not speaking to avoid feedback. Members present today are Senator Begich, Senator Costello, Senator Hughes, Senator Reinbold, and myself, Senator Wilson. We have a quorum to do business. This afternoon, we'll hold an initial hearing on Senate Bill 124, Medicaid Health Facilities and Medicaid and Meds, sponsored by Senate Rolls on the request of the governor. We'll take an overview of the bill today, take invited testimony, and take public testimony. Today, we'll just go through the bill first, through our first presenter, Mr. Williams, and we have Ms. Cunningham here from the Health and Social Services to help advance slides. So, Mr. Williams, if you can just let us know what slide and say next slide to go through the presentation. We're going to ask committee members to hold their questions to after the sectional so we have enough time to run through this bill.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Begich.
Just a personal privilege, if I may, just to embarrass our presenter for a second, if that's okay.
Yep, just let me, yes, that is fine.
I just wanted to wish you a happy birthday on the public record, Suzanne.
Oh, that is wonderful. Forgot all about that.
And this is to soften the blow. I just, you know, so thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. And with that, we have our two presenters that are presenting this bill by Teams today. Our Steve Williams, the Chief Operating Officer from the Alaska Mental Trust Authority, and Heather Carpenter, Senior Policy Advisor from the Department of Health and Social Services. And with that, Mr. Williams, you may begin your presentation.
Thank you, Senator Wilson and committee members. For the record, my name is Steve Williams. I'm the Chief Operating Officer with the Alaska Mental Health Trust, and we really appreciate the opportunity to give you the overview of Senate Bill 124 and how this bill fits into a larger effort to improve Alaska's psychiatric crisis response system. So if we could go to the next slide. And I will mention that it's kind of hard to see what slides are on the screen, so I'm just going to say you should be looking at the slide that is titled Changes Needed. And the what we'd like to convey to you as context before we walk through the sectional analysis is that currently Alaska's psychiatric crisis system is not operating in a way that best serves Alaska, best serves law enforcement and other responders, as well as our behavioral health system as a whole. Primarily folks responding to an individual who is out in the community in a psychiatric crisis are law enforcement, first responders, and others who often don't have the training to address the situation in the best way possible. And what happens is sometimes these folks end up inappropriately placed in either hospital emergency rooms or other more restrictive environments like jails. This bill is an opportunity to create some innovative change to our system, which it desperately needs. It will effectuate a no wrong door approach, which means that when law enforcement, first responders, or others encounter someone in the community in a crisis, they know where to go specifically to drop someone off, transfer the custody or care of that person to an entity that is well-equipped to meet their psychiatric crisis needs. It allows the opportunity for law enforcement to spend less time in an emergency room or other locale making that transfer. We know from other locales that have operated systems like we're going to describe today that the transfer from law enforcement to the appropriate healthcare provider can happen in 3 to 10 minutes. Today that happens more commonly in Alaska, several hours is the norm. The other big key piece to the bill is that it will allow the Department of Health and Social Services to designate and then to license lower levels of acute psychiatric care that are described in the bill as a 23-hour crisis stabilization center and a crisis residential center. The importance of the no wrong door approach is that those facilities, when they're licensed and designated by the department, will be able to accept someone who is in an emergency custody hold and or be able to accept someone who is there involuntarily. Next slide, please. So I'm hoping you guys are looking at the slide that's titled Goal, and you're looking at the top section of the slide, which shows what happens when someone's in a physical health emergency. I think we're all pretty familiar with this. It's the 911 system. We expect that if I collapse in my house, that my wife will be able to pick up the phone, call 911. First responders and EMTs will show up. They'll assess the situation, and if needed, they'll take me immediately to a hospital where I'll be transferred quickly, and the appropriate care will be administered to alleviate whatever the medical issue is at hand, which could include some hospitalization. The transfer between the ambulance and the emergency room department personnel is pretty quick. You know, I'm not sitting on a gurney waiting 8 hours for someone to come out to pick me up out of the ambulance. If you could do the next click, Suzanne, please. Hopefully what you see, okay, go back one, Suzanne, please. Below that slide, the bottom half is what we hope someone in a behavioral health crisis will experience as well, which is basically parity to our physical health emergency. By setting up a system where when someone calls who's in an emergency psychiatric crisis, or a friend or a loved one of theirs calls, that a dispatch center can identify what the situation is.
Hey, Mr. Williams?
Maybe even resolve it on the phone.
Yeah, Mr. Williams?
Dispatch.
Steve?
Yes, sir.
Okay, there you go. Hey, we're going to ask probably if you can turn off your video. We're not getting you clearly enough through Teams. You're not coming in very clearly. That might help serve the connection there. All right, thank you. You can continue. Sorry to cut you off like that.
No problem. Is this better?
So far, yes.
Okay. So at the bottom half of that slide, it illustrates what an appropriate.
Hey, Steve.
What an appropriate.
Yeah, Mr. Williams?
Yes.
We're losing you again here. Do you have a call-in number to call us telephonically?
Yes, I do, and I will do that right now.
All right. We'll take a brief at ease. All right. We are back on the record, taking a brief at ease for technical difficulties. Mr. Williams, are you with us?
I am with you. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes. Much clearer now. And you were talking about the bottom slide of what currently happens or what would happen if this bill were to pass to serve the goal of a behavioral health emergency.
Thank you, Senator Wilson, and my apologies for the connection. So what I was trying to describe there is that the bottom half of that slide is an illustration of what an appropriate response system for a person in a psychiatric crisis would look like. And what I'd like to call your attention to is the mobile crisis team and that 23-hour stabilization chair. You heard me mention earlier that a swift transfer to the appropriate provider for someone in a psychiatric crisis is critical. And with this system, we would drastically reduce the amount of time that law enforcement and other first responders would be spending trying to make the transfer from their care to the appropriate medical care. I would just also note that this system is sponsored and supported by the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, the Crisis Intervention Team International, which is a law enforcement organization, as well as the National Action Alliance on Suicide Prevention, and several others. Next slide, please.
Oh, wait, you can take a brief moment.
A question on the
oh, no, questions at the end.
Oh, sorry.
Yes. Please continue, Mr. Williams.
Thank you. So this slide is just to show you and illustrate an effort that began back in the summer of 2019 with the department and many others. These are large groups of stakeholder organizations that have been participating in assessing the strengths of communities, gaps in communities, as we redesign a response for a person in psychiatric crisis. I would note that we've met with over 300 organizations and individuals throughout this process. Our partners at the Department of Health and Social Services, DOC, Public Safety, the Tribal Health System, the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, the Tribal Behavioral Health Directors, Fairbanks Native Association, Tanana Chiefs, local governments such as the City of Fairbanks and the Municipality of Anchorage, our partners in the nonprofit community who are critical to providing the care in the community, as well as law enforcement and other first responders such as the state troopers, fire departments, and other local law enforcement. Next slide, please. So an enhanced psychiatric crisis continuum of care, what I'd like to focus first on is the left-hand side of this slide, because it's the work of the Department of Health and Social Services that to apply and then be awarded an 1115 behavioral health waiver that really is part of the strong foundation to be able to make this systems change. Through the 1115, we have the ability to enhance our community behavioral health providers and the way they serve and support people with psychiatric conditions and in a crisis, but it also allows for funding for pieces of the system that goes off to the right. And today I'm going to focus on the 23-hour stabilization and the short-term stabilization, because those are pieces that are critical and are included and mentioned in SB 124. Next slide, please. So that we're all on the kind of same definition and idea of what a crisis stabilization center would be, it would be a locale designated by the department and licensed by the department that would provide up to 23 hours and 59 minutes of crisis stabilization care. This bill would allow it to be a no wrong door, low barrier facility, meaning that when first responders drop someone off, they're dropping someone off at a center that has the medical staff, the mental health staff, and peers that can then take custody of the individual, myself, and assess me for what needs need to be met. And that could be some medical needs. It could also be medical needs on top of some mental health or other behavioral health needs. The other thing that is critical here is that having this designation also alerts first responders and law enforcement that they know that when they take Steve Williams to this locale, that the locale will accept them right away, that there won't be turned away, then they won't be sent looking for someplace else to take me to have a place to meet my needs. Next slide, please. The next slide, it describes what a short-term crisis residential stabilization center is, and you could think of it as one step up in terms of care. So if my crisis and my situation could not be resolved in less than 24 hours at the lower level of care, this could be the next level of care that I could be transferred to, and it is mentioned in the bill. Again, it's recovery-oriented. It's designed through this bill to accept both involuntary and voluntary patients, the no wrong door, low barrier approach. It's designed to have a multidisciplinary team, and then it's designed at the back end to make sure that when my needs are met here and I am released from care, that it's coordinated and the community is prepared to accept me to support me going forward. Next slide, please. This is a graphic illustration of what Georgia, who operates this system, has demonstrated in terms of outcomes that they've seen. So you can see the headsets are crisis calls to a crisis dispatch center. They receive 100 calls. They're able to resolve 90% of those calls, or 90 calls, on the phone. No other intervention is needed. For the 10 that they can't resolve on the phone, they dispatch a mobile crisis team, which is made up of a peer and a mental health professional, to meet me in the community to assess the situation, see if they can de-escalate it and refer me to the services and supports in the community that I need. And 7 out of 10 times they're able to do that. For the 3 that they're not able to do that, they transport me to a 23-hour crisis stabilization center where I receive the care there. And if I'm unable to receive the care there, then I get bumped up to the short-term residential crisis residential center. So you can see that, you know, by having a progression that provides for early intervention with the appropriate personnel at the appropriate levels, we can really minimize the impact on our first responders and law enforcement, and also, and probably more importantly, ensure that individuals get the appropriate level of care at the earliest point possible. Next slide, please. And maybe the next slide after that, Suzanne. Hopefully you're looking at a graphic that's titled Current Flow for Involuntary Commitments. What this graphic is illustrating is how our current system operates. And when you look on the left-hand side and you look at the hospital, ED, jail, and secure facility, the pathway where there's some emergency holds, this is a place where we have a sticking point. This is where first responders are spending time either in hospital EDs waiting to make a transfer if they can get into an ED, or an individual is sitting in a jail waiting to be admitted to an evaluation facility. I guess one thing that I would like to share just sort of to illustrate this point is in our stakeholder meetings and reaching out to law enforcement to find out, you know, how they see the system working or not working. There's a story from a state trooper who was out in the Matsu Valley who described a situation where he was called and dispatched to an individual who was in a crisis, psychiatric crisis situation. He was unable to resolve the situation right there. The individual went with him into the back of his police car, was handcuffed with the intent of being able to take the person and transfer them to the local emergency room, was not able to do that, was unable to find any other resources in the community to transfer the person to, ended up driving into Anchorage to try and find services, all the while this person's in crisis, in handcuffs, having committed no crime. And he spent his 8-hour shift trying to find the services for that person. This is not an uncommon story. It's a story if you sit down and you talk to law enforcement and how they respond when they get called out to these types of situations, they'll tell you that it's very difficult. It's difficult and frustrating when they can't make the transfer to the appropriate level of care. They'll tell you that when they can get someone into an emergency room, that they spend hours for that process to unfold, sitting and waiting for the hospital emergency room to accept the person before they can return back out to the street. And what that means is we have law enforcement spending an inordinate amount of time, you know, and I appreciate the fact that they do this, but they're spending an inordinate amount of time dealing with a behavioral health crisis for which they're not fully trained to deal with, instead of doing traditional public safety, law enforcement activities, investigating crimes, and otherwise. So can we flip the page, Suzanne, please? So the proposed statutory changes, if you look at the chair in the middle of the screen and focus on the right, would allow for law enforcement to take folks to this to these locales for a swift transfer to the appropriate level of care. And as we've learned from Georgia and Phoenix, Arizona, those transfers can happen in less than 10 minutes. Next slide, please. So in closing, I just want you to picture the what the system could look like and what this bill will help to effectuate. It redesigns our psychiatric crisis system. It gets people to the care they needed swiftly and at the appropriate level. It prevents them from languishing in ERs and jails. It minimizes the impacts on our law enforcement and other first responders. And it ensures that just like a physical health emergency, someone in a behavioral health crisis emergency gets the care they needed, the appropriate care, and in a swift way. And with that, I would like to hand it off to Heather Carpenter, who will walk through the bill sectional with you all. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Ms. Carpenter, we'll go to a sectional, then we'll take questions after the sectional.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Reinbold.
So we're not taking questions on the presentation?
That'd be right after the sectional. We're just going to go through the sectional, and then we'll take questions on the bill and as the and on the presentation. Mr. Williams will be around for that, and we also have a litany of other folks that are also online. We have Deputy Commissioner Al Wall online for questions, Director Jennifer Monroe Johnson, the Director of Division of Behavioral Health. We have Steve Bookman, the Assistant Attorney General. We have Katie Baldwin Johnson, Senior Program Officer at the Mental Health Trust Authority. Travis Wrench, the Program Officer at the Mental Health Trust. And we also have Nancy Mead from the court system also online as well to answer any questions that the committee might have. With that, Ms. Carpenter, the floor is yours for a sectional overview, and then we'll start with our questions after that.
Good afternoon, Chair Wilson and members of the committee. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. For the record, my name is Heather Carpenter, and I'm the Senior Policy Advisor for DHSS. So Section 1 of the bill amends AS 12-25-031-I1 to define a crisis stabilization center as a subacute mental health facility that has a maximum stay of 23 hours and 59 minutes. This is the statute that was added last session, first through HB 290, sponsored by Rep. Klayman, that was ultimately passed through Senate Bill 120. And you may remember that this sets up the alternative to arrest program. So in Section 2, which starts on page 1, line 13, through page 2, line 1, we are amending AS 4730-705A to expand the category of who can cause a person to be taken into custody for delivery to a crisis stabilization center or an evaluation facility. And this new language would allow a mental health professional, as defined in 4730-915-13, or a physician's assistant licensed by the state medical board to practice in the state, in addition to a peace officer. And I just want to remind the committee that we provided a definitions sheet for the definitions that are found in the involuntary commitment statutes, and that can be really handy for some of these sections. I'd also like to point out that all of the provider types that are in the language that is being deleted are captured in the definition of a mental health professional. And a physician assistant is currently not in that definition of a mental health professional, which is why we are specifically adding it. The next change in this section occurs on page 2, lines 9 and 10, and it clarifies that a person taken into custody by a peace officer and then should be delivered to the nearest crisis stabilization center or evaluation facility. And the desire here is to divert care to the most appropriate facility type for somebody in a mental health crisis to receive immediate care instead of in emergency rooms or jails. And finally, this section clarifies that a person taken into custody may not be placed in jail or another correctional facility except for protective custody purposes while they are awaiting transportation to a subacute mental health facility or an evaluation facility. And one more change in the section. Page 2, lines 19 replaces crisis stabilization center with subacute mental health facility to align with the definitions that you find in section 15, which categorizes crisis stabilization center as a subtype of the subacute mental health facility. Section 3 adds a new subsection C to AS4730705 that requires a peace officer to prioritize delivery to a crisis stabilization center if one exists in the area served by the peace officer. And our desire here is not to have a peace officer transport somebody from Dillingham, for example, into Anchorage. However, if somebody is in Houston, Alaska, and is experiencing a mental health crisis, and a crisis stabilization center exists in Wasilla, we'd want the peace officer to prioritize delivering that individual there instead of an emergency room. Section 4 has several subsections, and we're adding a new section to AS4730707 for admission to and detention at a subacute mental health facility with the following options and rights for a patient. So subsection A, which is found on page 2, line 26, through page 3, line 2, it creates the legal parameters for emergency admissions and holds at a 23-hour, 59-minute crisis stabilization center. It also requires a mental health professional to examine the patient who is delivered to a crisis stabilization center within 3 hours after arrival. Subsection B, found on page 3, lines 3 through 13, creates a new process for evaluation, stabilization, and treatment at a crisis residential center, which provides a less restrictive alternative to traditional involuntary commitment holds at a designated evaluation and treatment facility or the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. And if there is probable cause to believe the person's crisis could be stabilized by admitting to a crisis residential center, the mental health professional in charge at the 23-hour and 59-minute crisis stabilization center can apply to the court for an ex parte detention order, after which the person could be detained at a crisis residential center for no more than 120 hours. And in these sections, when you see the words professional person in charge, it has the meaning in AS4730915-17, and it means the senior mental health professional at a facility or that person's designee. In the absence of a mental health professional, it means the chief of staff or a physician designated by the chief of staff. Subsection C on page 3, lines 14 through 18, retains the option to use the current process of application for an ex parte order for delivery to a hospital that is designated as a DET, such as API, if the individual is determined to still be in an acute behavioral health crisis and need further evaluation. Subsection D on page 3, lines 19 through 23, requires that if any time during an involuntary hold at a subacute mental health facility, the patient no longer meets the standards for a stabilization hold or detention, they be released. Subsection E, page 3, lines 24 through 28, provides for the patient's rights when being involuntarily held at a subacute mental health facility. Some examples of these rights are the right to communicate immediately with your guardian or attorney of your choice, the right to be represented by an attorney, and the right to be notified of your rights. Subsection F on page 3, line 29 through page 4, line 2, allows for the patient to convert to involuntary status for care. Subsection G on page 4, lines 3 to 5, allows a subacute mental health facility to administer crisis psychotropic medication consistent with the current practice permitted in AS4730-838 for evaluation and designated treatment facilities. And subsection H, page 4, line 6 through line 9, adds language to clarify how time is calculated in this section for 23-hour and 59-minute and 120-hour periods. So, Mr. Chairman, Section 5 on page 4, line 10 through page 5, line 5, provides clarifying edits to 4730.710 and adds language to allow admission to a subacute mental health facility in addition to evaluation facilities. And it adds language to allow a mental health professional, after examination, to either hold the person at a crisis stabilization center, admit the person to a crisis residential center, readmit the person to a crisis residential center if it is within 24 hours of a previous admission with department prior authorization, hospitalize the respondent, or arrange for emergency hospitalization. Moving on to Section 6 on page 5, lines 6 through 10, A new subsection C is added to AS 473710 to require application for an ex parte order if a judicial order is not in place. On page 5, lines 11 through 23, a new subsection D is added, outlining the patient's right to request a court hearing and receive representation by a public defender if the patient is readmitted within 24 hours of a discharge and not willing to stay voluntarily. Section 7, that starts on page 5, lines 24 through page 6, line 2, amends AS 4730-715 to clarify that the facility type as an evaluation facility and to require admission of a patient when it is safe to do so for a 72-hour evaluation to determine if a petition for a 30-day commitment should be filed. And the reason we're trying to add this language is many facilities have different staffing patterns or several highly acute patients at the same time that could require 2-to-1 staffing ratio. So a facility must have the clinical staff available for treatment before they can admit a new patient, even if a bed is currently vacant and appears available. This is a clinical judgment in order to ensure the patient number doesn't exceed capacity or result in unnecessary injuries to patients or providers. This also ensures a facility can comply with all the conditions required by the Joint Commission and CMS for patient safety. So moving on to Section 8 on page 6, lines 3 through 16, it amends AS 4730-805A, computation of time statute, to include the computation for proceedings or transportation to a crisis residential center. Section 9, page 6, lines 17 through 31, amends AS 4730-838C to include the subacute mental health facility as a type of facility authorized to administer psychotropic crisis medication when there is a crisis situation where the patient requires immediate medication to prevent significant physical harm to themselves or others. So I want to lay out a couple of things about crisis medication that may help the committee understand this section. And currently, crisis medication can be given when there is a crisis situation or impending crisis situation. A crisis situation happens when medication must be used immediately to preserve life or prevent significant physical harm. Only a physician, an advanced nurse practitioner, or a physician's assistant can determine that a crisis situation exists. So a regular nurse cannot determine this. Providers will universally say that physical restraint is much worse for patients than medication. The order for crisis medication is initially valid for only 24 hours and may be renewed for up to 72 hours total. A facility can administer crisis medication for no more than 3 crisis periods without court approval. And because an order is valid for 24 hours, it may be renewed for up to 72 hours, which is to say 9 24-hour periods. And this almost never happens because regularly scheduled medication reduces the use of crisis medication. So moving on to Section 10 on page 7, lines 1 through 3, it adds a new section to AS 4730 to require the department to adopt regulations to implement these changes to the involuntary commitment statutes. Section 11 on page 7, lines 4 through 9, amends 4730-915-7 to clarify that an evaluation facility means a department-designated hospital or a crisis residential center. The current term of a healthcare facility could technically mean that a hospice facility, for instance, could be a designated evaluation and treatment center, and the department would never designate them as one, which is why we're trying to be more precise. And both of these facility types could be designated because they would have enough time to perform a 72-hour evaluation to determine if somebody needs a 30-day commitment. Section 12 on page 7, lines 10 through 15, amends the definition of a peace officer in AS 4730-915-15 to include an emergency medical technician, paramedic, or firefighter. And this is an important addition to align with the work happening in Anchorage around mobile crisis teams. Section 13 on page 7, lines 16 through 22, amends AS 4730-915 which again is our involuntary commitment statute definitions, to provide definitions for a subacute mental health facility, a crisis residential center, and a crisis stabilization center. Section 14 on page 7, lines 23 through page 8, lines 14, amends our licensing statutes that are found in AS 4732-010B to change crisis stabilization centers to subacute mental health facilities. And the term subacute mental health facilities is used as an umbrella term to encapsulate a comprehensive set of wraparound services that can occur in a variety of different crisis settings. The umbrella term affords the state the flexibility to grow the suite of crisis services available over time. Section 15 on page 8, lines 15 through 21, adds a new paragraph to AS 4732-900 to define subacute mental health facility in the licensing statutes. Section 16 on page 8, line 22, repeals AS 4732-905. This is the current definition for crisis stabilization center and will be addressed with our updated definition that is found in section 13 of the bill. Section 17 on page 8, lines 23 through 30, adds a new section to the uncodified law to clarify that DHSS will consider previously issued crisis stabilization center licenses as a license for a subacute mental health facility. Section 18 on page 8, line 31 through page 9, line 5, adds a new section to the uncodified law to allow the department to adopt regulations to implement this act. And finally, Mr. Chairman, section 19 on page 9, line 6, provides for immediate effective date of the bill.
All right. Before we go into committee questions, looking at the time and time management and also the folks you guys have listed for some of your invited testimony, we most likely will not get to public testimony today, and we will reschedule that to Thursday. So if those folks are online, we will start public testimony at Thursday's committee meeting. With that, we'll start with questions. Senator Hughes.
Yes, thank you for the presentation. And I want to understand if a person calls 911 and there's a behavioral health incident, if a law has been broken, are you suggesting they follow this route, or would that be a different route where the behavioral health help would come through the Department of Corrections? I just want to make sure my understanding is law enforcement is supportive. You mentioned a national law enforcement group that supports this. I'm wondering if we are hearing from local law enforcement that supports this, and would we be, if someone has a behavioral health crisis and also seems that they have broken a law, are we suggesting this route, or is this for people who have a behavioral health crisis who have not broken a law?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, this is Steve Williams, Chief Operating Officer with the Mental Health Trust. What we are describing today are situations where no law has been broken.
Great. Thank you, and do you have any support from any law enforcement entities in the state of Alaska?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, yes, we do. We're partnering with the Fairbanks Police Department. We've been working with the Alaska State Troopers, the Anchorage Police Department, other first responders and communities.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Senator Begich.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Steve, back on your presentation, I just had two questions. When I was watching your presentation, I saw that you'd listed as one of the partner organizations, tribal entities, and the fiscal notes refer to a couple of different issues around hospitals and non-hospitals as part of the fiscal cost of the bill. And maybe Heather, this is for you. I'm not sure, but so my first of these two questions is: Is the state anticipating that tribal entities will provide crisis stabilization centers in rural communities? Because I'm not sure they're eligible for any federal match. And so I'm just curious about that and the staffing have you been thinking about the staffing and the credentials and training issues around those? And then the secondary question is, in that fiscal note, you list that potentially one hospital and two non-hospitals might be part of the process. I'm just curious how you came about that distinction. So those two questions, one about rural facilities, tribal entities, and the federal match, and how we staff and the credentials for that, because this sounds very Anchorage-centric, which I'm comfortable with, but I want to know what our rural reach is for this bill. And then secondarily, again, in the fiscal note, you do indicate a couple of facilities in the text of the fiscal note, and I'm just curious about where you're anticipating those. So I'm not sure who answers that. Maybe Heather first.
Yes, Senator Begich, through the chair. Again, this is Heather Carpenter for the record. Those are great questions. And yes, the department anticipates tribal partners standing up these services. These are services that can also be billed through Medicaid through our 1115 behavioral health waiver. However, if somebody does not have insurance and needs to be covered for involuntary commitment care, the department is required to pay for that care by statute. So that is where traditionally we use disproportionate share hospital funding to pay for that. That is a 50-50 state and federal match. However, our tribal health organizations are not eligible for federal match through the DISH program. So that's why you see our fiscal notes reflect that. But we do anticipate, and we have several tribal partners who have indicated their interest in setting up services in rural communities, you know, such as Kotzebue, Nome, and some others. And the model is going to look different in rural Alaska than it will look in Anchorage. And the trust is working really hard with those tribal partners to determine how we need to scale the model in rural communities.
Follow-up, Senator?
Yes, and then the second question, when you talk about the identified, and I think it's the second fiscal note, just look here, it's 3234, OMB component number 3234. I'm just reading, the department estimates the two new hospitals that qualify for disproportionate share funding, et cetera, et cetera. I'm just curious what your, how the, up above it says state guidance only allows only hospitals to be designated, and I'm just curious how you identified the estimate for the two new hospitals, and that was just a curious question more than anything.
Sure, and Senator Begich, through the chair, I am going to phone a friend with Director Jennifer Moreau Johnson, who is on the line available for questions because she helped us put together that fiscal note.
All right, Ms. Moreau Johnson, are you online?
Hi, thank you very much. This is Jennifer Moreau, the Director of the Division of Behavioral Health. Chair Wilson, can I confirm that you can hear me?
Yes, ma'am. And did you hear Senator Begich's question, or do you need him to repeat that question?
Yes, I think so. Senator Begich, through the chair, you were asking how we arrived at our estimates for the hospitals that would be interested in standing up these services. Was that your question, Senator Begich?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Oh, great. Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Begich, you know, we have been working on implementing these services both through the stakeholder engagement that the trust has sponsored, but also separately along a different implementation path through the 1115 waiver. And so we have received requests for department approval from various agencies across the state to provide these Medicaid-based services, the short-term crisis residential, and the 23-hour, 59-minute Crisis Stabilization Center. And so we were basing our estimates based on those requests for department approval.
I appreciate that answer. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Reinbold.
So, Mr. Chairman, it's a little easier for me to remember questions if we're able to, you know, ask questions either as we go through or at least at the end of a presentation. So I guess I'll start with a few questions in regards to the presentation with Mr. Williams, I believe it is. First of all, can you describe anybody who's actually written a formal letter of support for this? For example, have the state troopers, I think I'm reflecting a little bit off of what Senator Hughes was asking, you know, the specific letters of support for this. I think first, is there one on, do we have any or not at this point? I'm not sure.
And I know, for Mr. Williams' answers, there was one that came in, I think, at 12, right before committee was going to start, that we will pass out to committee members. I don't remember who it was from, but I did see one letter come in, and Mr. Williams can answer if they received any other support or written documentation.
Through the chair to Senator Reinbold, the Trusted Four has not received any formal letters of support from law enforcement. Okay. However, through all these planning efforts that started back in 2019, law enforcement has been very supportive as we've worked through this process to develop a system that would provide a better response to people in psychiatric crisis.
So through the chair.
Yes, and Senator Rumble, I'll also let the committee know our second testifier for invited testimony is the acting chief, Kenneth McCoy from the Anchorage Police Department, may be able to answer a little bit more about police support, at least for the Anchorage police, but go ahead.
Okay, thank you. So what I find interesting is I believe it was Heather that said something about SB 120. Well, interestingly, I have a bill to repeal SB 120, you know, in the works that I've been meaning to release for the last couple months. I think it was Senator Giesel's bill on administrative of psychotropic drugs, so I had a real problem with that. So I've got a bill. So I just want her to explain how this works with SB 120, because you did mention that, and that's raised a serious red flag for me.
Senator Reinbold, through the chair, the only section of the bill that interacts with last year's Senate Bill 120 is Section 1, and it just amends one of the definitions from that bill. Everything else is standalone in the involuntary commitment statutes as well as the licensing statutes that we follow.
Okay, and then through the chair, can you provide a list of medications? Of course, this raises a lot of red flags for me. I want to know what type of medications that this can be administered, because people can have very, very negative reactions to psychotropic drugs. And I used to be in the field of pharmaceuticals. I think you guys know that. And I can tell you there's some pretty serious adverse reactions, even when you watch the news and they'll say, you know, a certain medication, and then they'll list all the negative side effects because they have to. And it's very serious. So people can have serious adverse reactions that can actually create a bigger crisis than the crisis to begin with. So I'd like a list of all those medications that can be administered, you know, within this first 24-hour period.
Senator Reinbold, through the chair, we will definitely talk to our psychiatrist at the Alaska Psychiatric Institute and try to get you a few examples from others. But this is going to change by clinical judgment depending on who the provider is who's giving these crisis psychotropic medications. And I just want to remind the committee that, you know, currently providers will tell you if they're not able to give crisis medication, they will have to physically restrain a patient, which they find is much worse for their care than crisis medication.
Through the chair.
Yes, Senator Reinbold.
Yeah, and that might mean, I mean, people could kind of probably freak out, I would think, when they were physically being restrained, and I could understand that. But there can also be very long and severe consequences to medications, products that are injected, you know, in their body. So, you know, I'm very concerned about that personally. And then in regards to page 8, there's a page 8, it said there's 100 crises calls, and then 210 mobile crises dispatches, 3 transports, and then admission to short-term stabilization. I have a question on that, and I believe that would be to Mr. Williams.
Yep.
Through the chair.
Yeah, if you can ask your question, he's online.
So it's what numbers and statistics were used to formulate this slide? That's the first question. And over the last 1 to 2 years, how many involuntary commitments would have been sent to the subacute facility based on this?
Through the chair to Senator Reinbold, the illustration data that's in front of you is based off of data that came from Georgia, the state of Georgia, that operates a system very similar to this, based on 10 years worth of data and 1.5 million callers. Similar data has been gathered and is similarly demonstrated in Phoenix, Arizona, where this model is also operating.
Okay, Can
follow up, Sandra?
Through the chair. So, Mr. Williams, do you happen to have a list of the medications that can be administered within the first 23 hours?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, no, I do not.
And I believe we'll get a sample list, and it would just be a sample, as Ms. Carpenter stated, that it was just depends on the crisis that an individual may go through at that given time.
Through the chair. I haven't even started on the bill yet, but the ex parte through the chair, I have a real concerns with ex parte issues on page 11 in particular, and also on page 12. Some pretty, our Constitution is there for a doggone good reason, and this just really, really troubles me. I mean, I have many, many questions in regards to the bill itself. This, again, is one of the most concerning bills I've seen all session. And so I have a tremendous number of questions on the bill itself whenever it's appropriate time. But I know Heather just went over it. But I can tell you I probably have a dozen red flags that immediately go up with me in regards to this bill. But 120, I didn't like that bill at all either. So, you know, it makes sense that I wouldn't like it. And I just want to know, Mr. Chairman, when is the appropriate time to go through the exact, you know, the questions in regards to the bill itself?
Well, let's continue to go around here to ask a few more questions. About 2:30, we'll jump into the invited testimony, so those folks can testify, and this bill will be back for us on Thursday, so we can continue sort of with the questions that committee folks may have on the bill. It is a very complex subject that has lots of moving parts, so we do want to take our time and to work through this piece of legislation. We'll go to Senator Costello, then Senator Hughes, and back to either Baggage or Reinbold if you guys have further questions. But about 2:30, we're going to move into invited testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the presentation of the bill. My question is about minors and how minors are dealt with in this legislation.
Through the chair, Senator Costello, minors would be able to follow this process if a facility accepted minors. So the department would need to know that a 23-hour crisis stabilization center or a crisis residential center had the capacity to accept minors. We do have some facilities that are getting ready to stand up services, for instance, in Ketchikan, that are very interested in serving minors.
Yeah, follow up, Sandra Casella.
Thank you, Heather. And what provisions are in the bill that would allow parents to be notified if their minor child had been taken to such a facility?
So, Senator Costello, through the chair, there's nothing in this current bill, but I can ask, phone a friend in Stephen Bookman, our Assistant Attorney General, who can answer how it currently works in the process.
Mr. Bookman, are you online?
I am. Can I be heard?
Yes, if you can put yourself on the record, and I didn't know if you need the...
Yes. This is Stephen Bookman. I'm with the Department of Law, and through the chair, I did hear Senator Costello's question, and when we talk about the section that talks about how the rights under 725 would be given... would be incorporated as applicable. One of those rights is that you would have the right to communicate immediately at the department's expense with the respondent's guardian, if any, or an adult designated by the respondent. And so I would think that would cover that issue.
Follow up, Sandra?
Yes, thank you. So does that mean that the minor chooses who will be communicated with, or would it be in statute that the minor's parents or guardian would be communicated with?
I think both. I think that the statute provides the guardian should be notified, and then also an adult designated by the respondent. We also see this in a different statute, Alaska Statute 47.30.775, labeled Commitment of Minors, which talks about how the earlier provisions, including the 725 rights statute, applies to minors, and also notes that any notices required to be served on the respondent shall also be served on the parent or guardian of a minor, and any parents or guardians of a minor shall be notified that they may appear as parties, and they can retain an attorney or have an attorney appointed for them.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to go to Sandra Hughes, then to Sandra Reinbold.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like specifically to follow up with Senator Reinbold as far as the letters of support from law enforcement, if we could actually maybe if you could reach out and get those so we can see what their view, your opinion is. And I'm also wondering if you, and I was relieved to understand that this, we're not talking about crimes committed. These are simply people instead of a medical issue, it's a behavioral health. So that was helpful. Could you tell us the estimated time per year that law enforcement officers across this state are spending on this kind of situation, so we would have a better understanding of how much time would be freed up to do their jobs related to public safety and curtailing crime? So that would be helpful. And then the question is regarding outcomes. If we use this method, would we expect to see better outcomes as far as the individual patients getting help instead of being repeat 911 calls and law enforcement showing up at their door? I'm just wondering if we have any research or data that shows the outcomes for the individuals is better. And then specifically to suicide, because if there's a family member that is very suicidal and threatening that, I'm wondering whether if the family member is able to tell that individual, I'm going to call a healthcare provider to help you, rather than I'm calling the police or I'm calling the troopers, I would think it would be more apt that that suicide person would hold off. And I'm just wondering if there's any data on that actually it for saving lives in that way, it might be better, because we know suicide is a horrific problem in our state. And I would just think that if a family member were told, we're going to call a healthcare provider, somebody who's going to help work with you, help you through this, rather than a trooper showing up, it might cause the suicidal person not to take their own life, perhaps. So if you could respond to that.
Senator Wilson, Senator Hughes. Didn't quite get all of them, but I can hit on a couple of them, and I think some of the questions you asked actually would be better responded to by the Department of Public Safety, the Alaska State Troopers, maybe other local law enforcement personnel. But I can tell you in Anchorage, having talked and been having the Anchorage Police Department work with us in this model, is that they average about 400 calls per month that are primarily a behavioral health crisis call. So there's a data point. It's not all the data points you want, but there's one. The other data point that I would share related to having a robust system like this in place. In Phoenix, what they found was that the amount of time that saved by law enforcement responding to a behavioral health crisis was 37 FTEs. So that wasn't suggesting that they needed to get rid of 37 FTE law enforcement personnel. That was saying you had 37 FTEs that could now focus on responding to crime, investigating crime, helping to prosecute crime, things like that.
And the suicide?
And we. I don't have suicide information on for you, but if there's time, I'm happy to call on a friend, or we can get back to you with that information.
Thank you.
Yes, and we're going to go to Senator Reinbold, and then we're going to take invited testimony after her question here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I guess I know House Bill 76 added, essential worker and non-essential, and frontline people get workers' compensation benefits if they get COVID. And it added behavioral health. So I'm just seeing some similarities line up in this bill. In Section 12, it defines the peace officer to include a state trooper, and then health officers, public health nurse, United States Marshal, and then it adds EMT, paramedic, or firefighter. So then when you go back to page one of the bill, it says in section two that a mental health professional or physician's assistant licensed by the state medical board to practice in the state, and then that's where it kind of starts concerning me, because it says it deletes a psychiatrist or physician who is licensed to practice in the state, employed by the federal government, or clinical psychologist that's licensed by the psychological and psychological associate examiners. It deletes all that, and instead it now puts a physician's assistant or a peace officer, which I just said, is now, for a reason, is able to commit somebody. And I guess that kind of concerns me, because I'm not sure that they're the right people. I'd much rather have somebody that has experience in this area be committing somebody than the police officers. So there's just multiple red flags in this bill. But that is definitely one of them. And then another one that has major red flags for me in this bill is section 14, which it includes ambulatory surgical centers, assisted living homes, child care facilities, child placement agencies, foster homes, freestanding birth centers, home health, hospice, hospitals. And I know a lot of these are in the definition already. But it's just, this is a pretty significant transformation of process. I just want people to know this includes maternity centers, nursing home, residential child care, residential psychiatric, runaway shelters, rural health, and now it adds the subacute mental health. That's a new, a new word in here. But this is a pretty global bill. This is pretty comprehensive and some pretty significant changes. So I'd highly recommend we really slow this down, because I think this is going to have riveting effects, across the state, and it poses significant, in my opinion, constitutional concerns, parental rights concerns, whether the proper clinicians are doing, the judgment, and now, frontline workers are doing it, the ability to administer psychotropic drugs within 3 hours. I could go on and on, but I could probably note 24, 25 concerns if I had 15 minutes to talk about this bill. So I will tell you, this bill is a deep concern to me.
You said we're going to hear this bill a few times this session.
Can you address the two things about the provider provider types and then the list of facilities and what that referred to? Just so we
Yes, Ms. Carpenter, that looks like she's ready to provide a quick response, and then after her response, we're going to go to invited testimony. Ms. Carpenter.
Yes, thank you, Chair Wilson. And through the chair, Senator Reinbold, the questions you raised aren't actually big changes. So the definition that you referenced in Section 2, as I said, everything that is being deleted is in the definition of a mental health professional that is found in 4730, 915, 13. We specifically call out physician's assistant because it is not in that definition. The definition that we are changing for peace officer only applies to the involuntary commitment statutes, and that is where we're just amending to add EMTs, paramedics, or firefighters. And like I mentioned, that was to accommodate the Anchorage model for their mobile crisis teams. Section 14 that you referenced is not our involuntary commitment statutes. This is a conforming change with our licensing statutes that are found in 4732. And that is why you see all of those healthcare facilities that are listed, because those are facilities that are licensed by the Department of Health and Social Services through our healthcare facility licensing. And I just want to reference, too, that when you're looking at that first emergency hold, the EMTs only get to do that first emergency hold. They don't get to do all of the rest of the holds at the crisis stabilization centers or the 120 hours or a 30-day commitment. Those, again, would only be done by what we look at what's currently in statute. So I hope that answers those questions as quickly as I could.
Through the chair, can I respond?
We're going to go to invited testimony, and like I said, this bill is going to be back before the committee on Thursday to finish up questions and to take public testimony then. I do want to get through these folks that do have to get back to other items.
Can I just make a small comment?
At the end, if there's more time, Senator. First person up for invited testimony is Elizabeth Ripley, and then followed by Chief McCoy. Elizabeth, if you can provide your few comments that you may have, and
Good afternoon, Senator Wilson, Senator Hughes, members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Ripley, and I serve as President and CEO of the MADSU Health Foundation and represent the foundation on the MADSU Regional Medical Center Board of Directors. The foundation shares ownership in MADSU Regional, and we invest our share of the profits back into the community through grants and scholarships to improve the health and wellness of Alaskans living in MADSU. I'm testifying today in support of SB 124, which will allow the Crisis Now model to be developed in MADSU and Alaska. I'd like to share a bit of the MADSU Health Foundation's journey that brought us here today. During 24 community forums as part of the 2013 MADSU Community Health Needs Assessment, the people of MADSU told us the top five health issues they were concerned about were all related to mental health and substance abuse. People told us they wanted an improved and coordinated system of care that makes treatment for behavioral health more readily accessible. To better understand the gaps and challenges in care across the behavioral health continuum, we thought we should examine the behavioral health crisis response system in MADSU to see who was showing up where and what challenges they were having. What we learned was shocking. The MADSU Regional Emergency Department saw 2,391 behavioral health patients in 2013 for a total of 6,053 visits, costing an estimated $23 million. These patients had higher charges, more frequent visits, and were more likely to return to the hospital within 30 days compared to other patients. An additional $1.6 million was spent on law enforcement, 911 dispatch, and transportation. Alaska State Troopers responded to 851 health-related emergency calls, and EMS ambulance services responded to an average of 432 calls. The prevalence of mental health and substance abuse problems and crises have only increased since then in MADSU and statewide. The average annual growth rate for visits to the MADSU Regional Medical Center Emergency Department by patients with a behavioral health diagnosis grew 20% from 2015 to 2017 due to the opioid epidemic and lack of treatment access. In 2016, 3,443 patients with behavioral health diagnoses went to the MADSU Regional ED. Their charges totaled $43.8 million, which doesn't count the additional costs borne by law enforcement or MADSU Borough EMS for dispatch and ambulance services. Additionally, from 2014 to 2017, the number of behavioral health assessments required for patients in crisis in the emergency department grew from 349 to more than 1,000. I'm happy to report that MADSU Regional opened a 16-bed behavioral health wing last January, which provides inpatient behavioral health treatment. We have reduced boarding in the emergency department, but not eliminated it. We still have people who need detox, space to sober up, and other behavioral health services that do not necessarily require an emergency department visit or require inpatient treatment. But right now, under current law, law enforcement must take people with a behavioral health crisis to jail or to the hospital, and there aren't any other options. Despite all our work at the foundation and with partners like the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and you, Senator Wilson, to create access to behavioral health treatment upstream of the emergency department, we still have a lot of people who require crisis intervention downstream. We need other options besides the emergency department and jail for people, options that are more cost effective. That is why the MADSU Health Foundation became involved in the development of the Crisis Now model in our community. Research estimates MADSU has 2,583 behavioral health crisis episodes occurring annually that could be served by any level of crisis services within the Crisis Now model. Most of these, about 2,500, can be served by the Crisis Now call line or mobile crisis team, but the rest may require the involuntary holds in crisis facilities allowed in this bill. MADSU is projected to need 9 short-term residential beds under the Crisis Now model. Ray Michelson, program officer over our Healthy Minds portfolio at the foundation, has been meeting with 30-plus behavioral health providers and emergency system partners over the last 9 months to plan for and establish these needed services in our community. The MADSU Health Foundation has budgeted grant dollars to help support capital and startup costs. The 1115 waiver should help to cover some of the operating costs. We are all in to help get Crisis Now off the ground in MADSU, but we need this legislation to make it legally possible. It paves the way for a new option to support residents experiencing behavioral health crisis, as well as for the law enforcement and healthcare workers who assist them. I respectfully ask that you move Senate Bill 124 forward. Thank you for taking time to hear my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Ripley. Next, we have Kenneth McCoy, Chief of Police for the Anchorage Police Department, and followed by Elizabeth King.
Good afternoon, Senator Wilson, members of the committee. This is Kenneth McCoy. I'm the Acting Chief of Police for the Anchorage Police Department. And thank you for having me this afternoon to discuss this very important legislation. So on behalf of the Anchorage Police Department, we do support a crisis response system in our community. Alaska, and Anchorage in particular, has relied on law enforcement and emergency medical personnel for our primary behavioral health response for years, and for my entire career, which has been 27 years at the Anchorage Police. We are supportive of building a complete crisis response system, which consists of a crisis call center, mobile crisis teams in the field, consisting of mental health professionals, and a 23-hour stabilization center are all very important components that are needed to adequately address mental and behavioral health in our community. We all know that the outcomes that we've received through law enforcement response alone has not led to the desired goals for us. Oftentimes, the person in crisis does not receive the appropriate care from a law enforcement response. Sadly, we know that a large percentage of these situations end with police utilizing some level of force against people who are in mental health crisis. These types of situations, we recognize, would be better suited by having professionals in the mental health and behavioral health field responding to those matters. Enhancing the resources in our community will free up the scarce law enforcement resources that we have. Right now, we respond to hundreds of calls every month, many of which are a result of mental health or behavioral health crisis. About half of those result in us having to take someone into custody and transport them either to the hospital or to jail, which may not be appropriate. Sometimes our officers are left with a person in their police car for hours at a time trying to find the appropriate resources in the community, the appropriate locations to drop that person off safely to be treated. And again, that is a drain on police resources that could be better utilized investigating actual crime, and it's not appropriate for citizens who are in crisis who truly need help, and being in the back of a police car only increases the emotional trauma that's taken place. So again, I intend to be brief, but we in law enforcement, the Anchorage Police Department, fully support this type of system coming into the community, and we fully recognize that this system and response model would not replace law enforcement 100%. We all recognize that there will be times where a law enforcement response is the most appropriate. For instance, if someone is armed with a weapon and acting out, or if a crime has been committed, those are primary law enforcement functions that we will continue to address. However, a system of this nature will only augment what we're able to do for our community and, again, free up valuable law enforcement resources while at the same time better serving people in need. So thank you. All
right. Thank you, Chief McCoy, and also congratulations. And we also have a request. If you could provide your testimony in writing, that would be helpful for committee members and for future committees as well to put on the record. And we have a we're going to say asking for clarifying questions on the testimony that was provided. Senator Reinbold.
And thank you. And again, I also want to congratulate you as our new APD Chief McCoy. I've met you, and I have been incredibly
pleased with the interactions that I've had with you in the past, so a big congratulations. What my question to you is that I'm very concerned about the involuntary commitment, you know, that it changes the definition of peace officer, the ability to administer drugs, and there could be serious adverse reactions. The fact that parents are just notified that they don't consent, they're just notified, kind of like the parental consent with abortion, that just really, really bothers me. So what I would like you to do as a clarifying question is describe a person that you would classify in this situation.
Sure. So there are many times where we see people who are in obvious mental distress, maybe just on the street corner, walking back and forth into the roadway, you know, causing a disturbance, not to the level where they've committed a crime, but yelling, you know, in just obvious distress. And I've had numerous times where tourists have flagged me down downtown to point out someone in that level of distress. And so in that situation, the person hasn't committed a crime, and from a law enforcement perspective, there's really not a whole lot that we can do for that person. We're not trained or equipped to help stabilize them. They haven't committed a crime, so taking them into custody is not appropriate, or taking them to jail is not appropriate. And we're not left with any other resources that we can direct the person to. Taking them to the emergency room, again, is a drain on emergency medical services for a person that's really not in need of that level of care. So having this type of resource in the community where professionals in the field can respond to this individual rather than uniformed police officers to help manage whatever the crisis is, help stabilize them, help get them to the appropriate resources, I think it's a win-win for the whole community. And again, with law enforcement, we found many times the uniforms, the lights, the radios, us showing up in that capacity sometimes is the catalyst for a use of force, whereas we would hope to de-escalate those situations. And by all means, we do provide our people with training and crisis intervention and intervening in these situations, but what we've found is it's just not enough. And these types of resources would only augment what we do and complement what we do and just better serve the community.
One more point, Mr. Chairman.
We got to get on to other folks here that have to get through their testimony here.
Okay, so I can't ask them another question?
We are going to ask you to folks to follow up offline for continued follow-up for folks that are on that, and I hope that the department will make some of these folks available to committee members, and I'm getting a nod yes.
Can I put the question
that
on the record, Mr.
Yes.
Chairman? Okay, so the question on the record is, can this be abused anyway? Can our new chief of police identify any areas where this could be abused in any way? But I did want to say thank you for his description very much. But I think that's really important.
Yes. And it looks like the department's going to try to get that answer back to the committee. Next, we have Elizabeth King. If she can put herself on the record and any affiliation and begin your testimony for about 4 minutes. And then Ms. Cheryl Holloway. Shirley Holloway.
Good afternoon, Chair Wilson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth King, and I am the Director of Behavioral Health and Workforce at the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. ASHNA supports the intent of Senate Bill 124, Mental Health Facilities and Meds, and continues to review the details of the legislation with our members. We do have some questions and areas where clarification would be helpful, and we support the concept and will be engaged in the process as we work to see if any specific changes need to be made. This legislation is intended to support increased availability of services designed to stabilize individuals who are experiencing a mental health crisis, specifically by allowing for the use of 23-hour crisis stabilization centers and short-term crisis residential centers. There have been ongoing challenges with accessible, adequate, and appropriate care for individuals experiencing a mental health crisis across Alaska and across the country. Alaska primarily relies upon law enforcement and hospital emergency rooms to serve people in behavioral health crisis, and most communities do not have the appropriate facilities and services where officers can take people to receive appropriate care. The result of this lack of service availability is that many patients unnecessarily end up in hospital emergency departments, one of the most acute, restrictive, and expensive levels of care. These patients who present at the emergency department are often held at the hospital for several hours or days waiting for access to the treatment that they need in a more appropriate setting. On average, behavioral health patients stay in the ED 3 times longer than patients with medical diagnoses. Expanding availability of crisis services has been recognized as an important part of the solution for reducing patient boarding in emergency departments and improving care for patients experiencing mental health crises. Senate Bill 124 offers the ability to support patients in crisis in a less restrictive, more appropriate level of care, regardless of whether they have a court order for an involuntary commitment. This capacity to provide crisis care for anyone, a no-wrong-door approach, is a cornerstone to building a successful model of crisis services, which are so needed here in Alaska. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Ms. King, for your testimony. Next, we have Shirley Holloway, followed by Bradley Grigg.
These are your invited testimony?
Yes. Oh, no.
Hello. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Well, hello and good afternoon, Chair Wilson and members of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee. I just want to say thank you to the committee for your thoughtful and really important questions. Your due diligence is really appreciated. My name is Shirley Holloway. I serve as the Vice President for NAMI Alaska, as well as the President of the NAMI National Board. I have served on the State Board of Education, and I'm a former Commissioner of Education Early Development for the State of Alaska. I found NAMI after the loss of my daughter to mental illness. As background, NAMI, the National Alliance for Mental Illness, is the largest grassroots mental health organization in the nation, with a mission of providing advocacy, education, support, and public awareness so that all individuals and their families affected by mental illness can build better lives. NAMI Alaska was created in 1984 and serves the entire state with affiliates in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, and in Oslo. These volunteer-centered organizations work in their communities to raise awareness and at no cost to participants provide education, advocacy, and support group programs. I'm testifying today on behalf of NAMI National as well as NAMI Alaska in support of SB 124 relating to admission to and detention at a subacute mental health facility as part of the overall Crisis Now initiative. But most of all, I am testifying as a parent. Alaska primarily relies upon law enforcement, EMS, and hospital emergency rooms to serve people in behavioral health crisis, and most communities do not have the appropriate facilities and services where officers can take people to receive appropriate care. This legislation will help to create a full continuum of behavioral health crisis response services, particularly at the appropriate lower levels of care. This legislation will allow Alaska to more fully implement proven crisis response improvements, including the nationally recognized Crisis Now model, by allowing first responders to bring an individual in crisis to a low to no barrier or no wrong door crisis stabilization center instead of an emergency room. The current approach to crisis care is patchwork and delivers minimal treatment for some people while others, often those who have not been engaged in care, fall through the cracks, resulting in multiple hospital readmissions, life in the criminal justice system, homelessness, early death, and suicide. A comprehensive and integrated crisis network is the first line of defense in preventing tragedies of public and patient safety, civil rights, extraordinary and unacceptable loss of lives, and the waste of resources. There is a better way. Effective crisis care that saves lives and dollars requires a systemic approach. The Crisis Now model is a continuum of three components that are already working in many communities to prevent suicide, reduce wait times in emergency rooms and correctional settings, and to provide the best supports for individuals in crisis. The Crisis Now model includes a regional or statewide crisis call center coordinated with the upcoming 988 crisis line, centrally deployed 24/7 mobile crisis teams to respond in person to individuals in crisis, and a 23-hour and short-term stabilization center, or sub-acute center, as this bill refers to, providing a safe and appropriate behavioral health crisis placement for those who cannot be stabilized by the initial call center or the mobile crisis team response. This new approach to addressing mental health crisis follows the national guidelines for behavioral health crisis care, using best practices endorsed by SAMHSA, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. These guidelines were developed on the experience of veteran crisis system leaders and administrators.
Ms. Holloway, if you could...
Yes?
If you could wrap up your testimony here. We're a little bit over time.
All right. I'm almost at the end.
All right.
I will skip the rest and go right to the bottom. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So my testimony is personal. This is not an abstract concept for me. I had a beautiful, talented daughter who lived with mental illness that I lost by suicide. For someone in crisis, there can now be an alternative to jail, API, and hospital emergency rooms. A more systemic response is needed, and this legislation is critical to getting us where we need to be, to develop a comprehensive mental health response system. This is not a magic bullet, but it is a critical first step, absolutely essential, to moving us toward a more compassionate, effective way of providing real help to Alaskans who find themselves helpless in the midst of a mental health crisis. SB 124 is part of an overall continuum of care necessary to implement Crisis Now, and thank you very much for listening to me, and I wish you well as you continue to debate this piece of legislation.
All right. And I apologize, Mr. Gregg, and I would love to catch up with you because I haven't spoken with you in such a long time, but we are actually out of time for the committee. I was looking at the clock that is actually a little bit slow. It is a little bit past 3. What we plan to do is that public comment can public testimony will open up public testimony, but also testimony can be submitted to Senate Hess, and that email address is shss@akleg.gov. Please submit your public testimony so we can include that in the record and distribute that to committee members. We're going to set this bill aside. We will bring it back up on Thursday, April 29th. I'm also going to let committee members know of the committee deadline time for amendments. Amendments are going to be due Monday, May 3rd at noon, so committee members have time to plan and to, after the conversation on Thursday, to start working with the department. If you have further additional questions you may want to have, to draft those amendments to get done by Ledge Legal into our office by Monday, May 3rd at noon. That concludes our business today, and we are adjourned at 3:03 p.m.